having a good weekend? I got a little bit tired in the middle of Geshe-la's talk yesterday. I went over to the, what's it called, the Tibetan Buddhist Learning Center. And in the break time, I felt fatigued, so I came back, but I'm feeling better today. Hope you're feeling better, or feeling good. You know, you weren't feeling bad before. So we're going to begin with a little meditation to calm our mind and to try to set a motivation, and also as an exercise in looking at the clarity of the mind. Okay, remember, I believe we did in this class also, after watching the breathing, we took our attention away from the breath and focused, rather than on the breath, focused on the subjective mind. We did in this class also, or no? You can nod your head if it's yes, or this way if it's no. You don't remember? You were in deep concentration, so you don't remember. Okay. So, the mind itself as an object, although very elusive and very difficult to identify, although it seems almost counterintuitive, it seems like you should be able to identify the mind, it's right there. But what you're doing is you're taking a little corner of the mind as though like a spy, watching the rest of the mind. And at first, noticing the content of the mind that's passing through it, because that's the most obvious thing that we always focus on. The thoughts, the feelings, the states of mind also, you know, that are developed from, let's say, some attractive object or pleasant object, so attachment will arise. As you notice the attractive object or the pleasant state, letting go of that, letting go of the other thoughts, letting go of placing attention on them. And you may notice in your life, if you don't pay attention to something, it begins to fade in its presence before you. It's not as actively there as a stimulant to your mind, whether it be attachment or anger. Also, there are positive states of mind. The object, you know, the thinking about the suffering of others or the poverty of others that can induce love and compassion and so forth. As you pay less attention to them, they begin to fade. It's not as though they're no longer going to be able to be called mind, but they're not prominent at that moment. And you're left, after some period of time, with a quiet state of mind, almost like space, like the sky. I've noticed over the years, Lama Sopa Rinpoche, when he refers to space, he's begun to call, in the last decade or so, he always says, like sky. I don't know, maybe in Chinese, it's more common, whatever sky, the English word sky is translated from, maybe that's, in Chinese, maybe that's more common in Chinese than the word that would be translated as space. You know, like an infinite. I always think of from my own point of view, sky sounds like something limited just around the Earth here. As you went into outer space, would you call that sky? Probably not. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you still call it the black sky or something like that. So here it's space is not that which has a color, like blue, space is not that which is like the color of outer space, black. Space is that which we know through our mental consciousness. The absence of contact, the absence of obstruction. So even though I see between myself and you what I think of as space, there's no objects that I can see there. We don't perceive space with our eye consciousness. Space is something that we perceive with the mental consciousness, that we know the absence of contact. So, say, for instance, even with the eyes closed, if I move my hand back and forth here, I wouldn't say that I'm feeling space, but because I feel no contact, I understand that there's no obstruction there. Okay. So that's what we will... We try to get a feeling of that space-like nature of the mind. How is the space like... How is the mind like space? It's like space in that it is unobstructing to the thoughts. Any thought that we want to generate can arise within the mind without any obstruction, without anything hindering its arising. Also, thoughts can be removed from the mind. It's not as like, not as though the mind were concrete. You know, like something is there and you can't remove it, like a fly stuck in the molasses. You know, you have to get in there and move it out. It immediately can dissipate from the mind. So we say the mind is like space. It's not space itself, but it has that kind of quality of being unobstructed. So let's begin, first of all, by doing a little breathing meditation to initially calm the mind. And then we'll transition into watching the consciousness itself. So again, without controlling the breathing, sit with your spine straight, sit straight up as much as you can. Eyes partially open, not completely closed. Those are the main elements. There are other elements, as you know, you've heard teachers explain the seven point posture. So let go of any preconceptions and just observe your breathing. And be aware of what is an inhalation when you breathe in and what is an exhalation. With yourself. Don't be thinking. Your only task is to watch your breathing. your body. No tension, but still erect and straight. Controlling the breathing, just observing. With one of the next inhalations, just watch it come in and leave your attention there in the middle of your chest. You'll continue breathing, of course, but no longer pay attention to the breathing. But pay attention to the consciousness that was observing the breathing. Here, I don't mean your eye consciousness, your ear, nose, taste, not even your tongue or body consciousness. Notice the flickering thoughts that may be coming. If you were successful in calming the mind a bit, there may not be a lot of thoughts to begin with. Some may come and disappear quickly. There may be some general general thought that remains a long period of time. Maybe frustration with the teacher, unhappiness with the MRT, or worrying about some bills or something like that. To see between the thoughts when the thoughts are not present, see if you can hold on to the moments of quietness, spaciousness of the mind. When everything is calm, peaceful, and when that's interrupted by a thought, just wait a moment. And when that thought subsides, don't pay attention to the thought. Don't grasp onto the thought or the image. But when that begins to fade, again, when there's a moment of spaciousness and clarity, try to hold on to that and make those periods of apprehension of spaciousness of the mind longer. If you feel you might be mistaking some light coming into your eyes for the spaciousness, occasionally open your eyes just an instant, close them again. You recognize you should not be paying attention to the eye consciousness. Trying to get a mental idea, a mental image of this spaciousness of the mind, because at first you can't touch it directly with direct perception, although eventually you can. You can perceive its clear light nature, but it's a very subtle object. It has to be approached by first getting an idea of it through these various exercises. Sometimes ask yourself, what is perceiving this spaciousness right now? As though you may have developed an idea, an image of the spaciousness of the mind. Turn your attention away from that to the consciousness itself that's perceiving that something that's more subtle, not something that's artificial. Your mental consciousness has no little hairs floating in it like our eye consciousness sees in our eyes as we get older. What do they call them? Floaters or something. As though imperfections in our sight. It has no cataracts. Think to yourself, I'm trying to apprehend my clear light nature. The clear light nature of my mind, the conventional clear light nature. Within which all of the good qualities that I aspire to, the qualities of Buddha, qualities of the aspiring Bodhisattvas, can be born within this consciousness. All of the faulty minds now, self-centeredness, ego-centric thoughts, anger, attachment, low self-esteem, low confidence, all of these can be removed from the mind. They're artificial, generally having very, very limited application to our actual life situation. So think, this is my endowment. This is what I have apprehension of now as a human being with a life of leisure and endowment right now. I'm going to make use of this precious treasure that I have begun to recognize in this meditation session, in this sitting together this morning and then later this afternoon. I'm going to use this opportunity to heal myself fundamentally, not just some limited healing, but the kind of healing that the medicine Buddha is known for, not just the physical healing, but the healing of all of the scars of our mind, the illnesses of our mind. Not just for my own peace of mind to be more tranquil, but because from that state I can better be able to help others. And to develop gradually the qualities of patience, generosity, very ethical state of mind that guards from allowing the delusions, the afflictions from governing in us. Perseverance, concentration, wisdom. I'm going to listen to the teachings, participate this morning and later this afternoon, so that I can progress with this great treasure I have right now, this clear light nature of the mind. I'm going to progress this lifetime, this day, this month, this year, this life, future lives, to the goal of Bodhi, enlightenment, for the sake of being able to spontaneously and effortlessly benefit all sentient beings. That's my goal. That's my final destination. And that's for the purpose of getting closer to that goal, I'll be participating today. This is what we call motivation. at the beginning of any action, the motivation is the most important factor that determines whether the action will be virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. Also, the states of mind within the action that may be changing. We may get irritated, we may get bit by a mosquito or feel hot or causing different afflictive minds to rise. But the general outline of the action is determined by the initial motivation. So then relax your mind, relax your body, bring your attention back to the present. Can you hear me okay? Let me see, someone in the back, can you hear me back there? Is it okay? That gentleman's still meditating. Or sleeping, I'm not sure which. No. He's probably in good concentration. So today and this afternoon, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, what are called the three principal aspects of the path. Is that right? Is that what's on the schedule? I haven't mistaken? Yeah. I'm afraid sometimes I'll prepared the wrong subject, you know. People are expecting something else. So, what does this mean, the three principal aspects of the path? The great Buddhist practitioner, not that long ago in terms of, you know, going back to the Buddha, but someone in more recent times, we call Jorje Atisha, who had traveled to Indonesia after a life of great study and eminence and practice of Buddhism, considered to be one of the crown jewels of the Buddhist practitioners at his monastery, even was functioning as the gatekeeper at a certain point that would determine whether people could be admitted into the monastery. It was only the greatest scholars who could debate with the people at the gate. If there was someone trying to sneak in who had some bad intentions, the gatekeeper would be able to decide through their debating with the person. So Atisha, at one point, you know this story? I'm going to say, you know, some of you know this story, some of you don't. Atisha was always trying to figure out what was the most important thing to get closer to enlightenment. Probably, maybe that's what we ask ourselves also as we go to the temples. Should I offer service to my parents? Should I do a long retreat? Should I do prostration? What is the best way to get closer to enlightenment? And as he was at Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha attained enlightenment. Some of you have been there probably. He was circumambulating the stupa there that commemorates where the location where the Buddha had sat when he achieved enlightenment. And he was asking himself these questions. That's the best way? What's the quickest way to achieve enlightenment? And as though in answer to it, he seemed to see two of the engraved like gods and various Buddhas that are on the stupa. Those of you know, there's some little statues in the niches, as though they were debating with one another, actually alive, and they were asking each other this question. And the answer was, the quickest way was to develop bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. Now, somehow we know, we've heard perhaps that there are two major elements to the finishing touches of enlightenment. One is the wisdom that realizes emptiness, sees reality as it actually is, maybe even sees all of this, even if the eyes are open, sees all of this as a conceptual construct of the deluded mind. The Buddha's mind does not see what we see here in the same way that we see it, as though it's really existing, but recognizes what we see due to our conceptions as devoid of that solidity that we attribute to it, the reality that we attribute to it. It's almost as though it's rainbow-like, just merely what people call these various appearances which are arising due to our karma. The kind of ultimate wisdom, say, or the wisdom that then centers just on their emptiness of that apparent solidity, just as like space-like meditation on emptiness. The other factor is this mind of loving kindness, altruism. We'll detail what the actual characteristics of it, what we call bodhicitta. Bodhi is Indian word, Sanskrit word that means enlightenment. Citta, do you know what citta means? Citta means mind. Generally, citta means one of the primary consciousnesses. So it's the mind of enlightenment. So the statues were saying, actually, the most important thing is the bodhicitta, sort of like the motivation. Why you're striving to realize emptiness. So Atisha, through his own research and maybe calling upon the advice of deities, tried to find with whom he could study and really make some progress in developing bodhicitta. And he heard about a teacher. Where? And Java? I'm not sure which island it is. Anyways, it's in nowadays it's the port called Jambi in Indonesia. Is that Java or is that another island? Is it? Louder? Sumatra. Yeah, because he was called Sumati. Well, anyway, he was called Sumati Kirti. It was on Sumatra. Java is a different island, or yeah, okay. So it's not Java. It's Sumatra. So he made a journey in the sea, in a boat with other people, that took a long time. It took more than a year. Generally, to travel from India to Sumatra, you have to travel at a certain. If you're going in that direction, you have to travel a certain time of year to use the trade winds, right? And then when you return, you have to wait till the winds are bringing you down again. There's a very good article. I'll see if I can find on the internet about a scholar who researched this from one of the great the chronicles of a great Chinese pilgrim after the initial pilgrims that used to travel to India via the Silk Route, right? At a certain point, the Silk Route became problematic for pilgrims to get to India to experience the direct transmission of Buddha Dharma. And some of them experimented with traveling by sea from China to India. One of these pilgrims got waylaid in Jambi and explained the great structures there, like Nalanda, huge kilometers of monastic colleges and debating courtyards and great monastic communities. So there's some reference to what was existing there at the time. So Atisha was on his way from India there. It took 13 months to get there, and during that time he experienced many almost disastrous, the boat almost sank, various kinds of tragedies with perhaps whales or squids, whatever they called these sea monsters. Maybe there were sea monsters there that we don't know of now, but they may be things that we still recognize. Finally got there and spent some time trying to hear about this great teacher he wanted to study with, who was called Dharmakirti. It was his given name. And at a certain point, he was able to be welcomed by Dharmakirti and his assembly of monks. They came down. They were all living in monastic discipline as a prerequisite. And he stayed there with Dharmakirti for some 13 years. Long time. You might think, I've studied with Geshe Chuni. I've done the basic program twice now. How many years now? 3 years, 4 years, 5 years? So he traveled more than a year to get there and stayed 13 years with Somadhikirti, just studying about all of the various methods that Dharmakirti had assembled to be able to generate bodhicitta. From that, the Tibetan tradition that Atisha later offered to the Tibetan people when he came to Tibet, the Tibetan tradition of how to develop bodhicitta, the Tibetan tradition of Lojong arose, to which we owe this great, great debt to Atisha. But while Atisha was in Tibet, he had made a promise to the abbots of the monasteries in India that allowed him to go there at the request. Long story, you've probably heard it various times. He made a promise to come back after a certain amount of time, a couple of years, but he could not return at the appointed time because there was a war taking place at the border between Tibet and Nepal. Obviously, you have to pass through Nepal to get down to India. And he went back into Tibet, and he composed a text called the Bodhipratapadipam, the lamp of the path to enlightenment. Or you could say the light that shows the way, that illuminates the path to enlightenment. And it was in this text that we recognize it was the first historical reference to these three principal aspects of the path being delineated out in a certain fashion, emphasizing them. The topic of today, the three principal aspects of the path, or the three principles of the path. So what are those? One is the state of mind that we can call renunciation. It's a state of mind. In Tibetan, we say ngejung. I can't remember the Sanskrit name for that. Ngejung can also mean taking leave. Like, for instance, if someone were to leave home, the life of a home, I don't know, say a couch potato, no, a homebody, the life of a lay person to become a monastic, that leaving of home is also called ngejung, sort of say, taking leave. So taking leave doesn't mean taking leave from work. You say, I'm going to take a leave from work. It's not like that. It means, maybe in a certain general sense, taking leave of the lay life, this lifetime, to pursue a monastic life, the life of a monk or nun. But renunciation doesn't have only that sense. It's the sense, it doesn't mean that you have to become a monk or nun to develop renunciation. Renunciation is a state of mind that has to be generated slowly and gradually and enhanced more and more. It's not something that's just like a snap decision. Oh, I've got renunciation. You know, I've renounced my father's wealth. I've renounced the family fortune or something like that. Just some snap decision. Renunciation is a state of mind that comes about by seeing really intimately the shortcomings of cyclic existence. that recognizes that we are going to continue taking rebirth within samsara, and that everywhere within samsara is the nature of suffering. There is no location that you could find within cyclic existence that you can remain without suffering. Yeah, there's some places that are better, right? Human life better than an animal life, which in turn is generally better than the life of the hungry ghosts, the pretas, and certainly better than the hell realms. If you were to be given a choice, better to be born as a human, obviously. But for the long term, you can't assure yourself. Do you need some lozenge? I've got some lozenges. Suikim? Do you like a lozenge? Would you like a ricotta? Here, I'm going to toss it to you. Because as soon as she started coughing, I began to... So I've got a couple extras here. Because I've been coughing continuously since I got here, so I know what that's like. So renunciation is a state of mind that sort of like has become disenamored with cyclic existence, with samsara, with all of the pleasures of cyclic existence, all of the so-called perfections, you know, wealth and power and intelligence to become a great scholar or a teacher or whatever that's revered by others. You might think that, oh, those are the great things, or to become something that some people might really want to do, to become president of the United States out of ego. You know what I'm talking about. One of my teachers, who is now the Ganden Tipa, the throne holder of the Ganden tradition, when he was visiting our monastery in Wisconsin, Deer Park, he had been a disciple, as he was growing up, of Geshe Zopa, who was now in his 90s. Geshe has passed away since then. But he would always come to pay respect to Geshe, to teach at the center. He still does in the summers. And so he was in his room that was prepared for him, the room they usually stayed in, one of the visiting rooms. And it was prepared very nicely. There were flowers on the altar, everything, bowls of fruit, you know, like when you go into the big hotels, they have these bowls of fruit and different things for you, right? And someone who had prepared the room, I was there listening to this, someone who had prepared the room said, Geshe-la, how is it? You know, we used to call him Kensur Rinpoche before he became Ganden Tipa, because he had been the abbot of Gyume Tantra College. So a former abbot is called Kensur. So, Kensur Rinpoche, how is the room? Rinpoche said, sort of like tired when after the question was asked. It's all samsara. He said, there's no wanting to get some compliment, I think, from him. That this, oh yeah, this is really nice. I feel really comfortable. It's all the same. It's all the nature of suffering. I remember, I think Lama Sopa Rinpoche or Lama Yeshe, in talking about the great Lama Lundup, Ken Rinpoche Lama Lundup, who many of you may know, came to Singapore so many times, helped in so many ways, and helped you when you came to Gopa. So, did you ever visit Lama Lundup's room? Anyone ever visit Lama Lundup's room at Gopa? You did? Oh, so one person. So I visited, and of course this was the early days, 74, 75, 76, when Lama Lundup was so busy taking care of so many boys, he didn't have a chance, and his room was just, maybe later it was taken care of by the boys, but it was total chaos, you know, and I think Lama Sopa said, you know, he has no time, you know, to do these things, he's just taking care of others, and... I think it was Lama Zopa said, asked Lama Lama Lundup, we called Lama Lundup then before he was, I think the Kempo. I think Lama Sopo was Kempo at that time. We asked, someone asked him, maybe Lama Sopo asked him, what do you want? Is there anything that you need? And Lama Lundup said, all I need is to get out of this suffering, get out of cyclic existence. So this is kind of the attitude of renunciation. Renunciation has two sides of a coin. One side is the mind that sees all of cyclic existence and its, from the greatest pleasures, obvious sufferings, but sees all of them as the nature of suffering and endless and unbearable when you really think about it. And the other side of the state of renunciation is the mind that's analyzed whether we are trapped in cyclic existence. Can we get out? Like the Buddha leaving taking leave of the palace. That was his great renunciation, right? Taking leave of the palace. His ngejong. Cutting his hair and going off to seek the teachers of in India at the time of how to escape from cyclic existence, finally determining for himself. So that state of mind that has both recognized that there is an escape from cyclic existence through practicing, ethics, concentration, and wisdom, the three higher trainings, that through wisdom you can cut the root of the delusions, you can uproot them so they no longer will function, and you no longer will take rebirth within cyclic existence. Having that kind of confidence, then seeking the path that brings about that wisdom. That's the second aspect. One side is seeing, looking at cyclic existence wow, just I really have to get out of here. Got to get out of this place. I was mentioning yesterday. It turns out it wasn't Eric Clapton, after all. Was it Eric Burton or something like that? Was it the Animals? Not the Animals. What was it called? The Animals. I mean, we got to get out of this place. There was some. Anyway, if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry. Just an illusion, cultural illusion to a song. So one side is a mind that looks at cyclic existence with displeasure, with renunciation. Whatever is offered to you, maybe you accept for the sake of the disciples making offering, but afterwards you may put under your bed. My teacher Lama Yeshe said that when he visited great Lama, who is the teacher of the Dalai Lama, who taught the Dalai Lama about bodhicitta, Kunalama Rinpoche was in Bodh Gaya. Was in Bodhinath. Lama went down with some of the students and said, after he had, he said, he's really Jesus. Maybe he's the emanation of reincarnation of Jesus. He's a great, loving saint, sacrificing himself for others. But the special quality of Kunalama at that point that he was mentioning was that even you offered something to Kunalama, he would smile and accept. After you left, he would put it under his bed. He wouldn't make use of it. He'd give it away to someone else, because there was nothing there. From the point of view of someone with real renunciation, there's nothing that's pleasurable there. Geshe Darge at the library, at Tibetan Works and Archives, one of my wonderful teachers over the years, used to say it's a little bit that attitude of renunciation is a little bit like if you were to bring a pile of hay to a hungry lion in the zoo. You see the people that have to bring, usually they bring meat, because the lions are carnivorous, right? They usually bring meat to the lions. They grab it and they savor it. So if you were to, if the lion is really hungry, but he's sort of sitting there, and you were to bring a big pile of hay and place it before it, they're sort of like, you know, like, what's this? You know, like, that's kind of the attitude of the person with renunciation. Whatever kind of pleasure you might try to entice them with, they're completely chilled out. You know, it's like, there's nothing there. It's like, what can a lion do with hay? You know, it's not interested in hay. Does that make sense to you? You understand? Do you understand? This young lady, yeah. Yeah, you, yeah, yeah. Ah, okay. Will a lion eat hay when it's hungry? Probably not. It might start eating its babies. Yeah, there you go. There you go. The zookeeper who brought the hay, the lion jumps on the zookeeper. But no, generally they don't eat. You're thinking very like us. Like if you're a vegetarian, or if you're a non-vegetarian and you can't get meat, then at least you'll eat the salad or something else to stay alive. Is the lion a little bit different situation? You have to think something more, a little more radical, okay? But that's good. Thank you, Doris. Yeah, he's going to eat the caretaker of the lion. So one side of renunciation is the mind that sees all of cyclic existence, all of the pleasures of samsara as of the nature of suffering. Not just the obvious suffering of hell and preta and animals and so forth, and the sufferings of humans, headaches and losing friends and, you know, all of the humiliations and hardships and so forth, but even the pleasures of cyclic existence as not worthy, you know, they're all, as we said before, changeable suffering. They can't be counted on. They're not real happiness. And then having thought about that, that's a mind that's of part of the mind of renunciation. But the real full renunciation is when you recognize that there is an escape from this and you begin to work for that goal, to escape from cyclic existence. In Tibetan, we call that tardo. Again, I don't know the exact Sanskrit for tardo. Tardo is a name sometimes Tibetans give, you know, their children or monks or nuns that name. There was one famous Geshe in America who was one of the famous teachers, Geshe Tardo. Tardo, tar means liberation, moksha. De means desiring, wishing. To wish for liberation. So you might think, oh, that's enough. The wish for liberation would be renunciation. That's not enough. Unless you really have that first side of the coin that sees the real defects of cyclic existence, just having tardo, the wish for liberation, that's not the fully qualified renunciation. In the same way with when we talk about bodhicitta, we'll talk in more detail later. Bodhicitta has kind of two aspects too. One that sees, that is motivated by the compassion for sentient beings that are suffering, and the other side that's wishing to achieve enlightenment for that purpose. So simply having the desire for enlightenment that's not supported by the compassion that wants to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings, that's not full bodhicitta. Do you follow what I'm saying? Is it too subtle? A little bit similar to this definition, this meaning of renunciation that has two sides to it also. One, it's based on a revulsion for cyclic existence. Like the Gandantipa when he came to Deer Park saying, this room that's so beautiful, I thought he would be so happy with it. It's all the same. There's no pleasure here. It's so kind of him to be teaching even at a moment like that, you know, leaving an imprint in people's minds. So in Atisha's text, the Bodhipratibhadipam, the lamp of the path that illuminates the path to enlightenment, he enumerated these three principal states of mind as being the essential elements that we could summarize all the rest of our practice into, and we could develop sequentially and simultaneously the mind of renunciation, the altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, and the wisdom, I don't have three hands, the wisdom that realizes emptiness, the way of inward emptiness. So, we mentioned a little bit about renunciation. Renunciation is the main life force in the Theravada, what we nowadays we recognize as the main school of the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas. Sometimes people think that's the only non-Mahayana school. The Theravada was one of how many lesser vehicle schools were there? Any of you studied? How many? 18, 14? At least 14. I think they said there were two main variations. There was the Vaibhashika that had 18 sub-schools. Maybe that's what you're thinking of. Or you know, various enumerations. Maybe there was some enumeration of 14. But generally the 18. And then there was the Sautrantika, that there were a couple of variations of that also. So of those, all of those, what are you, 20 kinds of Hinayana schools that existed over the centuries, nowadays mainly it's just the Theravada that's one of the 18 Vaibhashika schools that exist today. So in that, the main life force, the real practice of that is renunciation. the state of mind that has, you know, oftentimes because of that seeing all of the glories of family life and the life of a entrepreneur or whatever you want to say, you know, the wealth that you can accrue or the power you can become if you become prime minister of Thailand or Singapore or something, all of, you know, giving this up, you know, seeing all of that as a youth, let's say, seeing all of that as essenceless, and then becoming a monastic. That's generally in the Theravada countries, that's what one would do. To pursue then, that's the initial going forth. That's the initial ngejung, taking leave of the home life, cutting your hair, wearing the saffron robes. But that's not, just taking vows of a monk or nun doesn't mean one has renunciation. One takes those vows in order to develop real renunciation. They may be called sometimes renunciation vows. You know, you say, "I am a renunciate." You're not necessarily a renunciate. You've done that superficial leaving of home, the home life, family life, lay life. But the purpose of that is to find the right conditions to develop real renunciation, the mental state that sees all of the temptations of cyclic existence as like the sirens. You know what the sirens were? I don't mean the sirens on the emergency vehicles. You know, who were the sirens that I'm referring to? Anyone know? Severine probably knows because studied. Who were the sirens? When Ulysses, you know who Ulysses was? Huh? kind of sometimes maybe they looked like sea creatures. The sirens were these beings when the men on the ship, the long journey back from the Trojan Wars, Ulysses and his crew back, when was that, before 1,000 years before Christ? I don't know, whatever they say. Coming back from the wars, and the troops on and the crew of the ship are so tired, and they see these, you know, beautiful ladies coming up from the sea saying, "Come here," you know, enticing the men. Some men are walking off the ship, you know, half delirious and so forth. Totally illusory. Maybe sometimes there's some spirits manifesting like this. There's sometimes some external aspect to it, but partially, mainly our own delusion, you know. So we say temptations of the sirens that seduced the men onto the beaches, or, you know, to be devoured by animals and so forth. The Buddha, when he sat under the Bodhi tree and achieved enlightenment, what was the first thing that happened at night? The first temptations, you might say. Do you know the story of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree? The Maras, and they were the the first ones that came were not the violent ones. They came later. The first ones that came were the, you know, beautiful girls dancing and alluring. And the Buddha had, you know, the story goes that the Buddha meditated on impermanence. And in his own mind's eye, he saw them as they aged and no longer became so, you know, superficially attractive and alluring, you know, through that meditation on impermanence. You know the story, right? And later the king of the Maras sent these violent troops to try to scare the Buddha out of his meditation. He was trying to keep the Buddha from achieving enlightenment. So that recognizing the alluring daughters of Mara as illusory, like the sirens of Ulysses, like all of the perfections of cyclic existence, the splendors of cyclic existence, seeing them as the nature of suffering and being undeterred, unattracted to them, feeling renunciation to them. That's a hallmark of renunciation. So Atisha pointed out these three states of mind, these three principles of the path as the main things that needed to be practiced. There are many ways of cutting the pie. I've mentioned other times I was here. It's like if you have a big pie, and in general you don't get a pie that big in Singapore, do you? Pies are usually like 10, 12 inches. I think a big pie, maybe a pizza pie. You can cut the pizza pie different ways, right? You can cut it diagonally so you get these triangular slices. Do you like it that way? I don't like that way. I like this, cut it in rectangularly so they come out kind of square. But you can cut the pie different ways. In the same way, do you remember why this example that I gave before, Suikim? About, let's say, for instance, when we talk about phenomena, you can divide all phenomena into permanent and impermanent, or contaminated and uncontaminated, or, you know, you can cut up all phenomena in different ways. All from the same pie. It doesn't matter. You know, it's still the same stuff is there. So you can try to enumerate the various factors that you have to practice on the way to enlightenment. You can divide that up in different ways. You can say you have to practice the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. What's the general way they translate that in Chinese Mahayana? You seem to be there. No? What do they call it? The Bodhi Prakshas. Do you know the 37? What comes to mind? 37? 37? 37 vows, no. Anyway, 37 harmonies of enlightenment. They're things that you have to develop to achieve enlightenment, or different ways. You can enumerate all of the different steps, so three higher trainings and then all of these other things. What Atisha did was that he chose these three topics: renunciation, the altruistic mind of enlightenment we call bodhicitta, and the wisdom that realizes emptiness, as the three main subject matters, three main practices. So renunciation is the, let's say, the heart of the Theravada endeavor. If you are going to practice the Hinayana path, the Theravada path, to really practice it authentically, you have to have authentic renunciation. Not just the desire for liberation, but you have to see all of cyclic existence as faulty. And then to practice, what's the main practice for the Theravada after that, based on renunciation? I bet some of you know. Anyway. So what do you do once you've developed this renunciation? You know it's possible to get out of cyclic existence. You want to achieve nirvana, right? What do you practice? Do you practice the six perfections? Oh, why not? Loud. Those are the six perfections of the Bodhisattva in the Mahayana, right? Hinayana practitioners are not practicing those. They may know about those. They may dabble in that a little bit. But what's their main practice? Later on the Arya path, yeah, they say Eightfold. The main thing is the three higher trainings. In fact, the Eightfold Noble Path can all be surmised into the three higher trainings. Do you know what the three higher trainings are? Do you know? Hmm? Who knows? You know. Oh, okay. Oh, that man in the pink shirt there. Again? The higher training of ethics, the higher training of concentration, the higher training of wisdom. Right? Thank you. Correct. Yeah. he has a fan over here. So what does that mean? So we're talking about renunciation, right? So you could ask, why did Atisha, why didn't he mention these three higher trainings? Well, because renunciation includes those. Practice in renunciation is one that includes not only the state of wanting to get out of cyclic existence, but the actual endeavor to achieve nirvana, to achieve liberation. And what you practice on that, in that state of mind, are called the three higher trainings. They're called higher trainings. Well, what is it? Because what? Who knows? Some of the older students. Why are they called higher trainings? Why aren't they just called trainings? Who's the oldest student here? The gentleman in the coat and the glasses there. What's your name? Yeah. What's your name? What is it? Begyal? I think you're one of the older students, right? No? Who knows? Well, there are different explanations. Sometimes we say there are three trainings even in some of the Hindu schools, the Vedic schools, but they're not called higher trainings. Higher trainings are basically based on having taken refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and based on a sense of renunciation. Do you remember that, Suikin? Suki? Suki, right? So they're called higher trainings because from that framework of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and wanting to escape from cyclic existence, they are the trainings that one undergoes to do that. Training in ethics or morality, Sanskrit, that's called Shila. That's not the lady's name, Shila. I don't know if you know anyone named Shila. This is S-H-I. We could write it in English. S-H-I-L-A. Shila. Shila has an etymology coming from the word in Sanskrit, the root word meaning cooling. It's that which cools the mind. You know, ethics or morality. So the higher training of morality, let's say taking vows and keeping them, so that one's mind is, and being mindful of those vows, so that one is constantly exercising the mental factor, mindfulness, so that you're getting the good foundation for concentration. And keeping ethics causes the mind to be free of all the worries, because you're being ethical, you're not worried about people accusing you of stealing or getting in arguments, so forth and so on. If you keep ethical behavior, your mind becomes much more simple. You create virtuous karma in keeping those vows that you promised. You avoid the killing. What else? Stealing. Sexual misconduct, lying, divisive words, you could call it slander, harsh words, idle gossip, covetousness. That's the mental activity of a strong desire for that which belongs to others. We'll get that figure out. Malice, which is the mental state that wishes others ill will, that can later lead you to actually doing those things. Wrong views, holding very strongly to things that are antithetical to the progression to enlightenment, like really holding strongly there's no future lives, or karma doesn't exist, and it's all baloney. You don't say that here. Baloney? That's more American expression. The cheapest sausage when you go to get the meats to put on your sandwich. It's sort of like all the leftover meats that they put together. It's called bologna. So if something is just not worthy, you know, that's just bologna. Do you say that here? Doris, do you know that from New York or something? What is that? Is it Irish? Bologna is rooted is Irish? Okay, good. I'll have to check that out. I thought it was anyway, we say it in America, baloney. So on the basis of ethics, the next training he engages in is the training in concentration, right? Higher concentration. So that means not just because many Hindu saints, Vedic practitioners, I think Sufis from Muslim, and even some Christians maybe developed very good concentration, and they even had methods to develop single-pointed concentration, some of the Vedic scholars and so forth. But higher concentration, the practice of higher concentration, or training in higher concentration, is one that's based on refuge and renunciation. So there you go through the various stages to develop single-pointed concentration, or first of all, tranquil abiding. Have you heard of that state of mind, tranquil abiding? What do we call it here? Calm abiding. Tranquil, calm, whatever calms your mind, whatever seems more tranquil to you. Calm. She, nay. Nay means to abide or remain. Shiva means to pacify or to calm or to be tranquil. So that's a state of mind where one has successively been able to concentrate on a mental object and keep the various thoughts that might arise in your mind, to keep them at bay, that is to learn to ignore them so they no longer interfere with your concentration. It doesn't infer that you've conquered those thoughts so they'll never come back, just that you've learned how to concentrate on the object and let go of those thoughts. That's one of the main obstacles. The other main obstacle is what we might call a lethargic mind, you know, a mind that no longer has the strength of apprehension of the object, where you sort of just, even now, I left my rosary in my room. Say, if you're saying your rosary at night, have you ever done this? You forgot to say all your Chenrezig mantras, and you're late at night, 2 a.m, you're falling asleep, and you say, and the rosary falls. You know, you no longer have the strength of apprehending that, holding it, right? Is that familiar with anyone? Maybe more familiar is when you're watching TV late at night and you've got the remote, and then that drops from your hand. It's true. You know, it's time to go to bed. So when your mind begins to, not even at that point where you've lost the object completely, but when the mind begins to just lose its strength of holding onto the object, that's one of the other main obstacles to tranquil abiding, to develop in concentration. So once you've conquered these and you've developed tranquil abiding, what's the purpose for that? Is that the end in and of itself? It's possible, if you developed tranquil abiding, to develop many remarkable extraordinary qualities. You can develop clairvoyance to know the minds of others. Did you know that? Have you heard? There was once one of our teachers, Geshe Repton, who was teaching in India. He was teaching the Atisha's text, the Bodhipratibhadipam, the Jangchub Lamrim, the biggest assembly in Tushita in Dharamsala. And amongst the practitioners was one of his disciples who was a monk at the time, Alan Wallace, who some of you have heard of. Have you heard of Alan Wallace? I know some people have studied with him. He's given some courses in, was it Phuket or somewhere in Thailand? Oh, here? Here, but not here. That's very enigmatic. That's I was like, gate, para gate. What do you mean here but not here? Somewhere in Singapore but not at ABC. Okay. So anyway, Alan Wallace is a very excellent teacher now. No longer monk, a long time. But he was monk at the time, and when Geshe-la was talking about the benefits of single-pointed concentration, shamatha, tranquil abiding, calm abiding, and so Alan Wallace asked a question. He said, so you've mentioned that one of the things you can develop is clairvoyance. What is that method? I'll just remember that. You can tease him if you see him. Say, George remembers this story, but very lovingly, very lovingly. So Geshe-la said, Geshe-la was like this, like the renunciator. You look like the lion before whom you would place the hay. You know, just all the time. He looked at Alan Wallace and said, first develop tranquil abiding, then I'll tell you. Maybe that was the impetus, because Alan spent one of his life ambition sounds more worldly, but one of his noble goals was to develop tranquil abiding. But also, he mentioned to me once that he'd understood through the scriptures that to develop bodhicitta in this lifetime, one of the things that can accelerate that, in some people's view, was mandatory, was to have tranquil abiding. So if you're trying to develop actual bodhicitta, not just the temporary thought to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others out of compassion, but to actually have that thought, you needed tranquil abiding. So anyway, he's put a lot of effort into that. So what's the purpose of developing tranquil abiding? You might say, well, it's to develop clairvoyance. No, that's not the main purpose. Is it to develop bodhicitta? That's partially, maybe. But the main purpose is to, from the point of view of the three higher trainings, the main purpose is to act as the perfect support for wisdom that analyzes the nature of phenomena, analyzes the self. Ethics gives the correct support to develop concentration because you are keeping mindful of your vows, you're accumulating merit, which is a support to develop concentration, and you're having a quiet state of mind that's not constantly assuaged by guilt and fears and desires, you know. So on the basis of ethics, you develop concentration. On the basis of concentration, you develop wisdom. Well, you can develop wisdom all along, but it's the correct environment in which wisdom can be brought to its fruition. You know the example of that's mentioned in the sutras, going to a temple, some broken down temple, and seeing in this dark corner of the temple, you see some murals that were painted on the wall. They're already a bit faded, but in the darkness, you can't really see them, so you get a candle or a butter lamp, something, and you're holding it. But it's not the daytime, it's in the evening, let's say, so you need this lamp to try to see them. But because the lamp is flickering in the wind, you get a glimpse of it, and then it disappears. And then, you know, when the light comes back, do you know that kind of phenomena? If you try to see something? So that example is used to illustrate this, that if even you develop wisdom, unless you have a mind that's concentrated, so the clarity of your mind is there constantly, not flickering, the object remains constantly in view. Unless you have that, you can't really see it and analyze it and develop the benefits of the wisdom. Does that make sense? Colin? So renunciation, on the basis of practicing renunciation, in the endeavor to achieve liberation, you practice the three higher trainings to achieve that goal. And with the wisdom that realizes main object in the tear, sympathetic cough. Were you just coughing? Yeah, I just started coughing also. Does that happen sometimes? There's a story in America that in the city, sometimes if someone looks up, you know, like this, up in the skyscraper. Yeah, you'd looked up too, right? So everyone else in the street is looking up. There's nothing up there. Superman's not going by or anything like that. Or what's the other thing? Laughing. If one person starts to laugh, other people start to laugh. Even there's nothing to laugh about. But I think something about coughing also is a sympathetic. You know, I'm always on the verge of coughing. So if someone else coughs, I usually begin coughing. Sorry. So renunciation, one of the three principles of the path. The other principle, another principle, the altruistic mind of enlightenment. That's how we might translate it into English. Sanskrit name is bodhicitta. You could just say it, the mind of enlightenment. They add these extra words to give some context, the altruistic mind of enlightenment. That kind of gives a nice flavor because bodhicitta itself is not just the wish for enlightenment, right? Remember, renunciation is not just the wish to escape, not just the wish for liberation. What is also has to be there? The two sides of the coin. It has to be based on a mind that sees all of cyclic existence as really faulty. You're really motivated to get out of cyclic existence. Not just a superficial wish to get out. So also, the wish for enlightenment, like the wish for liberation, is supported by something not simply wanting to be the first person in Singapore to become enlightened. I can't say, maybe there's already some enlightened people here. Are there? Is there anyone who says they're enlightened in Singapore? How about in Malaysia, the other Indonesia, these countries? There was a little boy in Nepal a couple of years ago. I think it turned out to be a hoax. Do you remember this? Sitting under a tree for days at a time. And supposedly people say, oh, maybe he's already Buddha or something enlightened. What did they find out? He was being fed at night or something like that, right? There might be some people who claim, I think Rajneesh. Do you remember Rajneesh, those of you who are a little bit older? The Bhagavan Rajneesh. Didn't he claim that he was, he had become a receptacle for Maitreya. He was already enlightened. There are different people like this. You might want to achieve enlightenment because it seems like from that perspective, all of your problems will be over. You'll have omniscient mind. You can know everyone's secrets. Is that a good reason to want to achieve enlightenment? No. You can spy on others, you have all power. Others will make offerings to you all the time. Whenever you get hungry, you can just think of the people who are offering you food and experiencing that. That would be totally stupid, right? Reason to achieve enlightenment. I mean, there might be some people who think this. The desire to achieve enlightenment is one part of the entity, the state of mind of bodhicitta. The other state is having previously analyzed the situation of all living beings for whom one has developed compassion, recognizing that they've all been incredibly kind to us over innumerable lives. They've all been our mother. And if you think of our mother this lifetime, she taught us how to go to the toilet, how to cook, how to eat, how to be good. I always remember my mother telling my brother and I as we were growing up, I want you to be good boys. Still brings tears to my eyes, the teachings, the guidance. Having sacrificed so much, our mother, this lifetime, to give birth to us. Those of you who have children know the sacrifice you have to, while you're carrying the child in your womb, giving up things that you might like to have. You give up cigarettes and wine, hopefully. You're very careful. Incredible suffering that you know you're going to endure in giving birth. When the baby is born, you care for it with so much protection, protect it from so many outside influences. As it starts to become an infant, protect it from sticking its finger in the electric outlet or stepping off the curb when the trucks are going by, and always constantly alert. Giving education to the child, to us, we've been educated by our mother, as I said, not only the basic things, but always made sure that we got a good education, schools, and sacrificing for us, bringing us pleasures, giving us the milk from her own body, giving food, even working in certain lifetimes in terrible jobs in order to get food for her, us, her children. All sentient beings, like the mother of this lifetime who's done that and who has done the same numberless lives in the past. Every sentient being has been our mother. Numberless times, has been depthlessly kind. We just don't recognize it now. You have been my mother. Mom. Number 086. He had to check what his number was. That's you, right? 086. We don't recognize as mother. But the state of bodhicitta is not only desiring to achieve enlightenment. That comes as a later thought, but recognizing the plight of all sentient beings who have been our mother, to whom we owe this great debt of gratitude. Seeing their suffering and recognizing, because of having been trained in renunciation, someone who's training in bodhicitta already has trained in renunciation, knows about it, knows that it's possible to escape from all of these sufferings. One, in seeing the suffering of mother sentient beings as being basically unnecessary, they don't have to be suffering. Wouldn't it be great if I could lead them out of this suffering? Practice the path of renunciation or the path of the bodhisattva, so that they could achieve everlasting happiness, to sort of set them up in that state. How could I do that? Well, I could work for their benefit. I could build centers. First of all, make money so I could benefit centers, then work in the centers to give teachings, invite teachers to lead them on the path. But I'll have to die, and in the future life I have to start that enterprise again, maybe supplying money for people to go to Bodh Gaya to receive teachings, helping them. The only way that I can really bring about the happiness of sentient beings, though, is if I had higher realizations to actually teach them directly. I had clairvoyance and magic powers to lead them on the path. But even then, if I'm still within cyclic existence, I can't lead everyone out of cyclic existence. I can't lead anyone out of cyclic existence. What I have to do to lead people into enlightenment, I have to become enlightened myself. So the state, the mind of bodhicitta, like the mind of renunciation, has two aspects. Remember, renunciation, one part was tardo, wanting to achieve liberation. The other was based on an antipathy toward all of cyclic existence. Do you know what I mean by antipathy? Sort of like revulsion, disinterest, recognizing it as faulty. Like the Gandantipa seeing, being presented with this beautiful room, it's all suffering, just wanting to get out of cyclic existence. Like that, bodhicitta is based on, first of all, an apprehension of the suffering of all sentient beings, having developed a heartwarming affection for them in various ways, which takes a lot of effort to really feel empathy for others. Equally, all sentient beings, even those that we might now consider our enemies, or we might now consider to be obvious enemies of everyone, the great despots of the world, the Hitlers and the Stalins and the various Pol Pots. Generally, Pol Pot's considered a bad guy, right? Are there some that consider him to have been good? I think even revisionism, I don't know. So to feel on the basis of this empathy for others, deep compassion, wanting them to be free of suffering as soon as possible, then seeing the only way that one can quickly bring about their freedom from suffering is for myself to become enlightened. That's the reason you want to become enlightened, in order to alleviate the suffering of others. In the same way, the reason you want to achieve liberation is because you see it totally as worthless, as not bringing any real satisfaction, any happiness, always of the nature of suffering. So bodhicitta is a mind that has these two aspects also, based on compassion for sentient beings, wanting to alleviate their suffering, wanting to achieve enlightenment in order to enact that. So if we put that down, then how do you bring about that state of enlightenment? What do you practice? In the Hinayana sense, in the sense of renunciation, what did you practice in order to achieve liberation? As we said before, the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. No, there wasn't anything. I mean, in a sense, what was the thing that surmised the Eightfold Noble Path? I've forgotten my driver's name from yesterday. This lady, what's her name? What's your name? Bindra. So what's the main training that one engages in from renunciation? What's the main practice? Not the Eightfold Noble Path, but that which surmises it. The three higher trainings. You have to remember, three higher trainings. How many are there? Five? The five trainings? Three. Why are they called higher trainings? Based on renunciation and real refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So they're different than the trainings that the other schools engage in, say the Vedic, what we nowadays call Hindu and so forth. Other schools also have trainings in ethics and concentration and wisdom, but they're not called higher trainings. So the Bodhisattva, similarly, the person who's developed, the person who's developed bodhicitta is suitable to be called a bodhisattva. A person, a sattva, or courageous person, who is aiming for bodhi. Generally, the word sattva, is that something prevalent in the language here, sattva? You have a lot of Sanskrit words in your language. Also in Indonesian, there are a lot of Sanskrit words. What does sattva mean generally? Sattva can mean sentient being, what the Tibetans translate as semchen, having mind. In certain contexts, that's a translation of the word sattva. But in other situations, sattva is translated as pao, which means courageous one, like Vajrasattva. Do you know Vajrasattva, purification deity? What's that in Tibetan? Dorji Sempa. Sempa. So Sempa or Sembao. Sempa can mean courageous mind. Sempa. It's also translation of sattva, Vajrasattva. So it can mean Sempa. So a bodhisattva is a person who has developed bodhicitta. Simply taking the bodhisattva vows doesn't qualify one as being a bodhisattva, although some people believe that. The same way I said before, simply taking the vows of renunciation, you know, someone has become a monk, and they now say, I am a renunciate. Well, it's only the superficial sense of being a renunciate, right? They've left home, maybe, and maybe they're going to sneak back at night to sleep. Get a good meal from mom, I don't know, you know. But anyway, they're not actual. It's just the right condition in order to develop real renunciation, that first leaving of home. Same way, taking the bodhisattva vow provides the right environment to develop actual bodhicitta. When you have spontaneous bodhicitta in your mind, spontaneous wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, constantly. It doesn't mean that that's all you think about. Oh, I got it. It's that it's there, part of your primary mental consciousness. It's been imbued in your consciousness. So, on the basis of that, the way that you try to bring about then. your goal of enlightenment is to practice what are called the six perfections. Have you heard of the six perfections? Sometimes they're maybe more familiar to you than the three higher trainings. This gentleman, do you know what the six perfections are? Or are you a new student? You're a new student, okay. So you're excused. Okay. Who is an old student? Okay. Generosity. Use it, usual disorder. Okay. Ethics, similar ethics, maybe not exactly the same as the first of the three higher trainings, ethics. Patience or forbearance. Joyful effort, perseverance, whatever the other ways translate. Concentration? Okay, actually, in Sanskrit is dhyana, which can mean meditation. Sometimes we translate it as concentration, but actually you say dhyana paramita, you translate that as a concentration is usually samadhi, right? So people generally translate this as concentration, but actually it's dhyana, not Diana. That was the princess, right? Dhyana. You might think it's mispronouncing Diana, but what does dhyana mean? Do you know? What's the Tibetan word for dhyana? Samten is a very common Tibetan name also. You know, Geshe Samten or Losang Samten or something. Samten, stable mind. So dhyana refers to various things. It refers to the concentrations that can bring you into the form and formless realm experiences. In fact, do you know Venerable Brahm, the Theravada monk in Australia who often comes to Brahm, what is it called? Achan Brahm, he calls it, I say Venerable Brahm. So I've known him for some years. So Achan Brahm teaches his Sangha, particularly his monks. Nowadays, also has some nunneries, teaches them the methods to achieve dhyana. What's it called in Pali? Remember Pali? Jhanas, right? They don't have... it becomes jhana in Pali? I'm not sure, because it's not the conjunct consonants. But jhana, the things that you talk about jhanas, often people think of those are the higher concentrations where you are able to remain in concentration for a long period of time. So that's what's being referred to as this fifth paramita, fifth perfection. What's the sixth perfection? The perfection of prajna, of wisdom. The prajna paramita. So, and these are practiced in unison, they're practiced from the beginning, but their perfections are brought about on the various levels of the bodhisattva path, on the way to enlightenment. So just one thing about the perfection of ethics. There was a gentleman here the other day, I'm not sure if he's still here, so we've mentioned his name was the same as mine, Sultram. Is Sultram still here? Mr. Sultram. He had been given a Tibetan name a couple of days before that. Do you remember? Was he in this class or was he other class? In this class. So, what's the difference between the ethics in the three... Theravada, Hinayana, three higher trainings, and the Mahayana Bodhisattva practice of ethics. Do you know what the difference is? One is more extensive, and that's easy to guess which one is more extensive. The Mahayana practice of ethics is more extensive. So generally in the Theravada, in the Hinayana practice of ethics, the main thing is abstention from harmful actions. How do you go about doing that? You abstain from the 10 non-virtuous actions as a person, or you take vows. You know what I mean by abstain? That means you consciously, it's not just like you think at night, oh, I didn't kill today. Oh, so I kept ethics. Keeping ethics means a conscious abstention from something. Given the opportunity to ask the person to drop the lobster into the boiling water or not, you say, no. That's practice of ethics, okay? Abstaining from killing. So you might think, there's very few times when I can keep ethics. Because very few times you have the option of killing or not. Maybe if you've got a lot of cockroaches, there's lots of opportunities. So what's missing from that point of view? How can you keep abstention from killing? How can you keep that, create that ethics all the time? Day and night, 24 hours a day, even when you're sleeping. Do you know? You know. Bodhicitta, maybe, but you take a vow not to kill. Say in the Hinayana, you take a vow not to kill. As a lay person, you take a vow not to kill. And if you have taken that vow with a strong determination, sincere determination, of course it may not be as strong as other people's determination, but while that determination is still present somehow within your mind stream, whether you're conscious of it or not, day and night you're creating virtuous karma for not killing. It's an incredible benefit to keeping vows. Those of you who have not taken the vows of a lay person, do you know what the five vows are? Not to kill, steal, to engage in sexual misconduct, to lie, to take intoxicants. So generally, we said that generally in the vows at the time of Buddha, it said alcohol. Nowadays, I think it should include things like, you know, other things that cause you to lose your inhibitions also. But generally, so of those five, if you take the vows, I wonder if any of you know, some of you are older students, of those five, which is the one vow that you traditionally, according to the scriptures, you had to take? If you took any of them, this one you had to take. Was it? Not killing, right? Not harming? That's the vow you had to take? Anyone dissent? What? Of those five vows, which one, if you take only one, because you can take one up to all five. I can't understand what you're saying. Say a little bit more loud. That last part. So the if you accidentally what? I think it's still off, your microphone. Anyway, that's good enough. So I think you may be hinting at it. Actually, originally, of those five vows, the one you had to take was not to take intoxicants. And a lot of times when people take the vows nowadays, that's the one they don't take. But that's the one you're supposed to take. Why? Because I think what you were saying was that if you take intoxicants, then you get drunk, then you may kill the sheep in order to have dinner with the lady with whom you have sexual relations. You break your vows of celibacy or your vow with your wife. You steal the goat first of all, then you kill it, you know. So the taking of intoxicants was the one that you had to take. Then in certain traditions, this may be more than you need to know, but anyway, certain traditions, it became when you took the any of the five vows, it was always done within the context of taking refuge, a certain ceremony in which they added, implicit in that, because you take refuge in the Dharma, is not to harm sentient beings. So as an adjunct to not taking intoxicants, you always had to take two vows. You had to take not to take intoxicants, but not to kill. You had to take those vows. In later days, as the Dharma has been spread to different countries, I think maybe it might have been in Tibet also, but especially as it comes to the West, even the vow about intoxicants as mandatory is dropped. So the thing that comes in people's minds is that you have to take the vow of not killing, whereas that wasn't the original intent. That was just within the context of taking the vows in the context of taking refuge. Okay. Yes, Doris. For everybody. For instance, the great disciple of Atisha in Tibet. Do you know who that was, the great disciple he waited for a long time? What was his name? Drondempa, right? Drondempa took the vows of a lay person. So he didn't take the vows of a monastic. But keeping those vows of a lay person, if you keep them well, you're almost like a nun or a monk in your actual, you know, practice, you know. You're incredibly virtuous, incredibly beneficial. So probably there are few people I can't say that, I don't know. How many people here have vowed not to take alcohol? Okay. Good number. Okay, good. Is it difficult? 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 Over the years? Not difficult. Yes. Difficult, right? Who said yes? Because you had some Italian blood in your Chinese, yeah. Italians. Is the microphone not working?
Yeah.
I think there's a switch on the bottom. Maybe he turned it off. There, I hear something.
So, Verbal, I asked that question because I've heard different lamas saying different things about drinking. Like His Holiness always says, oh, well, you know, you're allowed some chang, but it's like you're allowed, but just don't get intoxicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can drink, but you shouldn't get intoxicated.
So,
whereas others just say, well, don't drink, you know.
So the vow of a monastic is not to take even a drop, right? So I'm not sure. I think it depends on the severity of the interpretation, according to the teacher. Some people would say not to take at all. Others would give more liberality, like the Dalai Lama. Lama Yeshe used to say, you know, just at the table, you know, that if you're with Italians, you have to, you know, drink them. You know, you take a sip of wine, you just don't overdo it. But then again, you have to recognize, if you're like me, if you put before me a bowl of potato chips, you know, even though I may know, I'm trying to do a ketogenic diet, is carbohydrate. In general, it's not good for you, but you say, I'll just take one, you know. And then you're talking, your hand is just, have you ever done that? Or peanuts or something like that? Or I'm not sure what else would be like that. It's so, one, maybe those teachers who prescribe that you should not have it all, that's the meaning of the vow, have that in thought in mind, that even you have the best intention, just taking a sip, you know, losing your concentration. You may take another sip, and I think sometimes can grow on you. You can become a little bit intoxicated, not having recognized. You thought, oh, I just had a couple sips. Well, maybe more than a couple, and then you something slips out of your lips, you know, abusing someone or hurting someone's feelings or, you know, saying a lie, just because you have no longer have that introspection to watch your mind, because that has that inhibition, so to speak. That's why I think that's why a lot of people drink alcohol, isn't it? To lose their inhibitions. You know, at the bar, they'll talk to someone else. Or like at the Japanese party, the sake, then they ask all the questions that they were shy to ask before. So that's just for your, you know, so in the Mahayana, the ethics is not simply the abstention from non-virtuous actions. That's the main sense of ethics in the school of renunciation alone, say in the Theravada or in the Hinayana schools. The main sense of ethics is abstaining from creating non-virtuous actions. Generally, the Mahayana talks about the three kinds of ethics. What are the three kinds of ethics? Do you know? You're scared, no? You don't know? I thought that was a sign you were itching to tell me, because you're scratching the itch. I want to tell them I know. The three Mahayana. Yeah, what are they? One to what? So that's the one that's common with the ethics of the Hinayana, right? And then?
Action and...
Again, you have to put close and still speak out loud. It sounded... I can't hear you. You have to put it close to your mouth.
Refrain from negative action.
That's one.
Yes.
Two? None of you have been... None of you have been rock and roll singers, because the rock and roll singers always know they have to put the microphone close to their mouth. Do you ever see them on TV when they sing? They're always holding very, very close, because they put the volume down on the amplifier so the microphone doesn't pick up the crowd's cheering. So it's only picking up. So you have none of you. She's not been a rock and roll singer recently. She's holding way, way back. So first is abstention, negative actions, then ethics
and then
of...
After that, well, mature your root virtues will grow.
To accumulate virtuous dharmas, yes. Literally it says. So that includes creating virtuous karma, but it also means accumulating virtuous qualities such as single-pointed concentration and the ability to be generous. It also includes... listening to Dharma discourses, to receive the lineages, to be an upholder of the Dharma, all the various ways that you collect virtuous Dharmas. So the Dharmas here is not limited just to virtues, creating virtuous karma, but that's generally what comes to mind. But it means all of those things. Lama Zopa Rinpoche receiving so many lineages to keep those lineages. That's an example of the morality of accumulating virtuous dharmas. When you read and you study and you accumulate the dharma knowledge, that's accumulating. If done with wishing to benefit sentient beings, this is an example of the ethics of accumulating virtuous dharmas. And the third?
Engage in the welfare of sentient beings.
The ethics of benefiting sentient beings. Benefiting sentient beings. You may say, well, the other things were also benefiting sentient beings. But this means explicitly, for instance, when someone is sick, going to the hospital, going to their room to bring chicken broth Some people brought me chicken broth when I was sick the first couple of days. I thought, oh, there's an example of, you know, the ethics of benefiting sentient beings. In the Bodhipratipadipam, there's a list of how many? 11 methods of benefiting sentient beings. So generally, that would mean going out of your way to bring benefit. If someone's crossing the street who is old and having difficulty carrying their bags, to help them. All the various ways that we benefit sentient beings. So that's, of the six perfections, that's the one I've just to mention. The perfection of ethics is much more expansive than the the higher training of ethics. You know, if you just talk about the higher training of ethics limited to the Hinayana or Theravada school, that's mainly abstaining from negative actions, taking vows and so forth. If you apply the three higher trainings, you can include all of the six perfections in the three higher trainings. So the three higher trainings of the Bodhisattva, that higher training of ethics is different than the higher training of ethics of the Hinayana practitioner, which is mainly talking about abstaining from negative actions. Okay. So I'm only going to have time this morning to mention the third of these three principles of the path. In the afternoon, we'll spend more time. The perfection of wisdom, the prajna paramita. Geshe Damdu Dorje Damdu was mentioning at the beginning of his classes, he's been reciting these two mantras, one of which is the mantra of the perfection of wisdom. Do you know that mantra? Some of you has been at Geshe Dorje's class, know, but do you know the mantra of the perfection of wisdom? Tadyata om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi svaha. Sometimes explaining the five paths of the Bodhisattva. Gate, the first path, gone beyond the ordinary person's aspirations. Gate, again, gone beyond that, the path of preparation. Gati gati, paragati, gone beyond, like paramita, paragati, the path of seeing, where one is no longer considered to be an ordinary being, one has become an Arya being. Parasamgati, completely gone beyond the path of meditation, where one has progressed through the bhumis, or is progressing through the bhumis to get closer to enlightenment. Then bodhi, the path of no more learning, enlightenment. Svaha, may it be, may it take root within my mind. So in the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, Shantideva says in the chapter on wisdom, all of these previous perfections, perfection of generosity, ethics, patience, meditation, or dhyana, let's say you could call it concentration. Joyful effort, concentration. These five, all of these were taught for the purpose of this, the sixth perfection, the perfection of wisdom. This is what actually gets you out of samsara. This is what actually will bring about enlightenment. Of course, not by themselves. You can't get out of samsara with realization of emptiness alone. You need renunciation as a motivating factor to accumulate merit to bring you along the path. Simply the realization of emptiness, the perfection of wisdom, alone will not bring you enlightenment. You need to have the motivating factor of bodhicitta that propels you along the path that accumulates merit. And which is simultaneous with all of your activities. But the wisdom that realizes emptiness, the prajnaparamita, and eventually becoming direct realization of emptiness, we sometimes call the mahamudra, the great seal, that is what brings about the culmination of these two ambitions, to escape from cyclic existence or to achieve enlightenment. It's what all of the rest of the conventional level, you know, renunciation, all these practices dealing with conventionalities, helping people that you see with your eyes, all of this, from a Buddhist perspective, have no true existence. They don't exist the way that they appear. They only appear due to conceptualizations, due to our past actions. Through the Buddhist mind that sees the ultimate nature phenomena, all that appears is emptiness. Not just empty, but the lack of inherent existence. The Buddha knows what appears to us, and he does perceive what we perceive, but he perceives it in a different way. Like, for instance, at the soap opera, in the soap opera, do you use that term for on TV? The dramas in the afternoon on the TV? Is that part of Singapore language, soap opera? That's what they call them. You know why they're called soap operas? Doris knows, all Americana. Yeah, the sponsors, advertisements, where it's like soap powder or something, they call them soap operas. So operas, you know, all of these things that we see, we go, oh, you have your... Brad has left Jennifer, you know, or whatever. All of the things you get caught up in, you know, the dramas, or maybe the, you know, the war things, or rooting for one thing or the other. You get caught up in that. It's almost as though it's real. But if you just... They're called... You hear they're called Korean dramas? So that's good. Okay. Okay. In Korea, they're called Singapore operas. No, I'm just teasing. I don't know that for a fact, but that's interesting, Korean dramas. So you know what I'm talking about. So like that, the Buddha sees all of this as like our, you know, all these poor people. They're believing all of this is real. This is all just something transitory, changing. So the wisdom of emptiness, we're going to talk about more this afternoon. So let's take just a moment to dedicate provisionally the merit that we've created this morning. Stand back. Watch your mind. Once you become proficient in looking at the clear light nature of the mind, you can let go of thoughts more easily. Recognize that this morning, with our nice motivation at the beginning, and with our attention to the discourse, with our interaction, questions and answers, we've created some virtuous karma that definitely will give result within cyclic existence. If undedicated, it might be simply part of this Korean drama, in this Korean soap opera of cyclic existence, or at best, we may experience it as some temporary relief that we call samsaric happiness. But I can, by my volition, by my desire, I can actually wish, make a determination that in whichever way this ripens, may it become a cooperative cause for my continued Dharma realization. From day by day, life by life, may it become the essential element, the necessary ingredient, cooperative condition to develop renunciation, bodhicitta, and the right view of emptiness, so that I can practice the bodhisattva path. If I'm fortunate to encounter the the very rare quick path of secret mantra, Vajrayana, quickly achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. This is what we're investing these virtues in. Not for ourselves, but from that state to be able to most perfectly benefit sentient beings. Thank you very much. So we'll take a break.